Did somebody say playoffs? The NBA, MLB, and NHL are in full swing, and our partners at BetOnline have you covered. As you know, if you've been watching basketball lately, the NBA is at a fevered pitch right now. The Eastern Conference looks like a collision course between the Miami Heat and the Boston Celtics, but if you don't want to count out the Milwaukee Bucks, that might be a decent bet to make that they come back from an 0-2 deficit and eventually get to the finals or win a championship, who knows. And also, miraculously, the NFL is returning next week, so there'll be plenty to bet on. So take full advantage of sports being back and get in on the action with hundreds of odds, futures, and props for you to bet on. And there is always the online casino as well. It never closes. So head to betonline.ag today and sign up to receive your welcome bonus on your first deposit. Again, that's betonline.ag and sign up today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Everybody, Bill Roden here. Welcome to another edition of Bill Roden on Sports. I'm here at a still undisclosed location, but in Manhattan, in Harlem, USA. But that's all you're going to get.
Wi-Fi looks good wherever you are.
I know. It's unusual, man. I don't know. Maybe it's because my birthday's tomorrow. And so the internet gods is like saying, let's give this boy a break.
Thank you.
But I know Jamal Murphy, my friend, co-host, holding it down in Brooklyn, USA. Murph, what's happening?
What's up, Bill? I'm good. You know, can't complain. U.S. Open got underway today, so I was watching a little bit of Serena warming up. I don't know if they started, but you know, everything's good in Brooklyn.
Yeah, well, go ahead. I know you're very excited, as I am, with our guest today.
No doubt about it. We have a tremendous guest on today. Really, has been at the forefront of all this, all these athlete protests that we've really seen leading the way, and you know, leading everybody else, leading the country. Really, when you think about it, we have Elizabeth Williams with the Atlanta Dream. She's been with the Atlanta Dream since 2016. She was Most Improved Player in 2016, All-Star in 2017. The fourth overall pick by the Connecticut Sun in the 2015 draft. She went to Duke. You know, some of you may like that, some of you may hate that, but
exactly.
Duke from, you know, she played at Duke, of course. Her brother is actually a standout freshman at Duke this year. That's interesting. From Virginia Beach via England. And, you know, like I said, Elizabeth, you've been in the forefront of all the political protests going on in the WNBA that all other leagues have pretty much copied. So we just want to say thank you for that and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat it up with you guys.
So wait a minute. England, could you tell us that first? tell us.
Well, it's actually just that. So both my parents are Nigerian and my dad's a doctor. So after he finished his medical school in Nigeria, he studied a little more in the UK. And so I just ended up being born there. And then they came to the US once he finished his master's in the UK. So I was only there for a couple of years. I don't really remember much about it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. My daughter's fiance is Nigerian, Nigerian American.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So whatever. I guess we're part of the same family. But I know there's so much we want to ask you, Elizabeth, but I do want to echo what Jamal has said, that I'm so appreciative of what you are doing. I just think it's spectacular what you're doing. And then when you look back, you know, let's go back to sort of your roots in this. Like, you were at Duke and all that. When did you have you always been sort of activist type of person? Have you evolved into an activist type of person? Just tell me the roots of your athletic activism.
Yeah, if you would have told me that I would be considered an athlete activist when I was in college, I probably would have laughed in your face, because it's just not necessarily in my nature, but I think as I got into the W, and I kind of saw these powerful female athletes, you know, protesting way back in 2016 when it was a lot more controversial, just being a part of that type of group, I think I've just continued to grow in understanding what activism looks like in sports, and understanding the Black Lives Matter movement and understanding what voter suppression looks like. So as I've just continued to learn these things, I think that's kind of how the activism has grown, because I'm pretty low key, pretty introverted. But this is something that's important, and I think that's why I've grown to speak out more about it.
Well, what was the match? I mean, were you sort of like the typical, what the stereotype of sort of the typical student athlete? I just want to play ball, go to school,
yeah.
my degree,
yeah.
don't want to rock the boat. What tipped the scale? What, an event?
I think probably participating in my first protest right after George Floyd's killing. That was like my first time really being out and like truly in a protest. I think when some of the stuff happened in 2016 with our league, with players wearing the Black Lives Matter shirts or kneeling, I wasn't super involved in that. And I think I was still kind of learning my place in like this activist role. But I think probably this year, with all that was happening in our movement, and then in negotiating for what this bubble season was going to look like, and understanding how important social justice would be in that, I think that was kind of the tipping point for me.
As I mentioned at the beginning, the WNBA playing such a pivotal role in all of this, and you guys have been doing this for, you know, years in terms of, you know, keeping awareness out there, what's going on in our communities. Mm-hmm. And now that you see the NBA and other leagues, you know, doing their part also, is, do you take pride in all of that? Like, do you recognize, you know, that the WNBA was kind of like the, you know, laid the groundwork for all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's what we've seen in a lot of like civil rights movements, where Black women do a lot of the work, might not necessarily get the credit, which, I mean, that's just how it is. But at the end of the day, like, we're just here to do the work. And so whether it's talking about, you know, police brutality, talking about voting rights or voter suppression, we've tried to do that from the beginning. We've had, you know, players are really passionate about this stuff. I know we've had players from Chicago talking about violence in communities, and we had our W Wears Orange campaign just bringing awareness. So we've just, you know, from the beginning tried to push that. And I think other leagues are able to see the organization that goes along with the activism. So making sure that you're talking to these organizations that are on the ground in addition to protesting, in addition to kneeling. And I think I think we do take pride in that. We kind of laid the groundwork for what that looks like.
Well, let's go back to, we're not going to mention this person down in Atlanta, the L word. We'll just call it the L word, right? The L word. But that's really what kind of blew my mind. I said, whoa. That's like really strong. When you said, you know, how did that evolve, and what's sort of been the pushback? And I thought that was tremendous when you took somebody who was a co-owner, we'll just call it the L word, of your own team, of your own team, and were very offended, thought that this person was very disrespectful, and you basically said, cool, we're just going to support your opponent. What was the pushback? What is the pushback, and what impact has that had?
Yeah, so that whole situation was tough because initially, as members of the Dream, we didn't really know how to react, what to say, what to do. There were other players in the league that, you know, obviously made it very clear their feelings on it, but we were hesitant to come out and say something right away. And then after we had our Zoom call with players and staff, we wanted to make sure that in addition to making a statement, basically, you know, supporting Black Lives Matter, reminding people that this is a movement and a statement of equality, we wanted to have some type of action that went along with that. We didn't know what that was going to look like. But then eventually in conversations I'm on the executive committee of our union, And we always, our group chat's always going back and forth. We just, you know, have ideas, just going back and forth. And obviously our situation came up and we said, you know, what could our action item be? And what's a way that the whole league could support us? And then Sue Bird said, you know, she does have the Senate seat. What about, you know, supporting Raphael Warnock? And so then it headed into obviously vetting Reverend Warnock, having conversations with him, making sure that he supports what our league supports, you know, a majority Black league, you know, him understanding that. And so then the idea of supporting him and wearing the T-shirts came about. So on our first ESPN game, in addition to all the Atlanta players wearing Vote Warnock shirts, the entire league wore the Vote Warnock shirts. And we just thought it was a good way to kind of level up and saying, you know, in addition to saying Black Lives Matter, we also want people creating policies that reflect what that means. And that was just, that was how it came about.
What's the pushback? I saw some statement. What's the pushback been from then until now? Again, I just thought that was such a brilliant move. What has been the pushback internally, just A, on you? And yeah, what's the pushback now?
I mean, our owner just doubled down on the statements that she'd made before, because the intention around her statements was to create this kind of political wave, you know? And so we're like, well, we're not going to be used as pawns. So we're just going to kind of level up and think past this. And so we, as players, basically put the burden on the league as far as what they want to do with the ownership, because at the end of the day, like, we're just playing, like, we're not the ones that get the owners and vet the owners. So we kind of pushed that onto the league. And so now we kind of wait, but we made our move and haven't heard anything directly from her or her staff or whatever, but that was kind of as expected anyway. So we just continue to move forward with Reverend Warnock.
Along with that type of protest, you know, with the T-shirts, I mean, you guys have been so innovative and so hard hitting in terms of, you know, what you do say, what, you know, what messages you know, on the T-shirts. You had the Jacob Blake T-shirts with the seven bullet holes in the back of the T-shirt. You know, where do you, like, how do you guys come up with this perfect protests? Like, you know, like you said, is it a group text? You know, how much thought is behind it?
Yeah, it's kind of a mixture, I think. The Washington Mystics are the ones who wore the Jacob Blake shirts with the seven bullet holes, and they obviously had complete support of their staff and their ownership. And ultimately, this league has been player-led, so anything that we've decided to do has been led and driven by the players. Even our decision to not play, you know, that day that the Bucks first initially decided not to, it was a conversation. I think a lot of times people don't realize there's a lot of conversations that go into this. And we were the first game, we were playing the Mystics that day at 7, and we're actually out on the court talking to each other about what does not playing look like? What does the future look like? What are the ramifications of this? But actually having that conversation and hearing all the sides, that's, I think, what's allowed us to make, to be very strategic about what we've done as far as it pertains to social justice.
Were you surprised? You know, again, you know, Jamal and I talked about that. I've been covering this stuff, you know, like, you know, these issues probably since, like, for pay, since like 1973, you know, and have been involved in stuff as a journalist, writing about this stuff and all that. Having said all that, when I got the news that the Bucks were not going to play, I was like, what? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I always thought it would be like maybe at the Final Four, you know, when teams would not play before tip-off. Your reaction when you found out that they weren't going to play, did you know it in advance? And if you didn't, what did you say?
Yeah, we didn't know in advance. I mean, we were at the point where we were already at the arena, right? So we got to the arena, kind of texts were flowing in, tweets were flowing in about the Bucks. So we were supposed to play at 7. So we were there around 5. So you can imagine, like, initially some people were shooting, but the Mystics came a little later and they said, like, hey, we talked about this on the bus. Like, is it possible that we kind of support our NBA brothers and do this? And the stakes are a little different for us, right? We don't have this, the platform that, that the guys have. And a lot of our strength is in being seen. And we're fortunate in this type of season where almost every single game has been televised on national television, where that's not always the case. And so for us, a lot of our strength in our social justice has been because we've been out there and people can see us. So a lot of the talk about continuing to play that night was, hey, we've been able to get a lot done by playing. But I think ultimately, mentally and kind of emotionally, people weren't ready to play. And it felt appropriate to not play and then use our day of our day without games to kind of refocus our energy and recommit to social justice and kind of have a mental break, because we've just been constantly playing every other day, fighting for social justice. Like, it's a lot, it's heavy. Like, this is not easy stuff, you know? And so ultimately that was how we came down to making that decision.
I have an ownership question. I guess, you know, in all these, the struggles, mm-hmm. you know, you think about what's the end game? And the reality is that there is no end game. This is existential. This mm-hmm. is probably going to be, this is never going to be over.
Right.
You know, it's never going to be over. You know, my role at now is basically, it's like I look at it as an eternal relay race, you know, that mm-hmm. you run your leg and then you give it to the next generation, force them to take it. Don't pass it off. So, no, I'm not passing it. You take it. You mm-hmm. take it. You run as hard as you could run. Then you hand it down to the next generation, you know, the next Elizabeth, well, whoever that's going to be, the next generation. And just to me, you know, it's like this is existential. You know, this is never going to be over. This is going to be right. ongoing. So I guess having said that, what's the next step? You know, the season is going to be over. We got an election mm-hmm. coming up in November. Then whatever happens, we got what are the next steps for you personally and as athletes, as a group? What is sort of the next levels of this?
I think the biggest thing is keeping the pressure on. So whether it is even after the season, continuing to talk and tweet and post about voting, continuing to do those things about Breonna Taylor, continuing to say her name. I think a lot of what makes it difficult is that we stop talking about these things, right? Like, we'll have these periods of, yeah, Black Lives Matter, woo, and then everyone goes back to their regular life. I think the challenge now is being able to keep the pressure on, being able to make sure people are registered to vote and that their registrations aren't being purged, like continuing to talk about the things that we're talking about and not letting there be a lull in what we're doing.
Along the same lines, I mean, it's been amazing to see how sports have really been the leader in terms of, you know, more so than the government, you know, mm-hmm. and the government has followed, the people have followed. So, you know, not just, you know, with racial justice, but also COVID-19. You guys mm-hmm. are in safe bubbles. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rest of us, which, you know, we're out here looking for bubbles that we can
right. go into, you
know? So, and then moving forward, like you guys were really a leader in terms of other sports, and now sports in general seems to be leading mm-hmm. the rest of the country. Have you noticed that? And is that like an added responsibility or added pride? Where do we take from here knowing that you have such a big influence?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with football season, because yeah. I think we really need to make sure, even at the college level, that players understand their power. And I think if the NFL can kind of get on board with what we're saying and what we're doing, I think that's really powerful, because I think our country runs on football. And so if we can get NFL players and NFL owners and eventually like the corporate sponsors, that leads and bleeds into the political changes that a lot of us want to see. So I think moving forward in that aspect, hopefully these fall sports can take from what basketball has been doing, the NHL and WSL, like all these current sports are doing, it can kind of move forward with it.
Let me ask you about that, Elizabeth, because that's, I think you just hit the nail on the head. What I think is that the players have almost gone as far as they can go. You mm-hmm. now need the multi-billionaires mm-hmm. who run the leagues, who own the teams, who have connections mm-hmm. to all the other power people, you know, whether it's the police, benevolent, the unions, mm-hmm. Other owners, you know, who meet in the Hamptons and, you know, they have these discussions, which I've never been in, but there's a whole nother level mm-hmm. of multi-billionaire discussions and you use your leverage. What do you think about that? I just think at this point, because of everything you said, you're really going to need the active participation of the multi-billionaires to do more than just say, okay, here's $2 million for this. You know, throw mm-hmm. money at it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's tough. I think if we want to talk about, like, first of all, just diversity and inclusion, you can start looking at the owners and saying, okay, who are you hiring? Who is, you know, running your teams? Who are your GMs, your CEOs? I think that's one way that you can start to see change, like a multi-level change. And then I think they have the opportunity to kind of do the same in relation to the corporate sponsors that they work with and making sure that the businesses that they work with are doing those same things. And then a lot of them, when you get to that level, you have politicians in your ear. And so making sure that there are policy changes that reflect what players want to see and making sure that, you know, different, that the cities that if there's a team in Detroit, right, you still want Detroit to make sure it has the proper resources for education and proper making sure policing looks how it's supposed to look. And so they have the influence to do that in their cities. And so players can do so much with their foundations and stuff like that. But when it comes to resource allocation and influencing cities to look how we want them to look, I think the owners have a big part in that.
Have you had those discussions with them? I mean, across the board. Clearly, one of your owners clearly probably not on board with that. But
right. Yeah.
But have you begun to have, who's you were? I thought you guys were very smart. All part of your board of directors. You got a politician.
Stacey Abrams is Stacey on our Abrams. Board of advocates. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How has that been? In other words, having somebody who's actually a strategist. Mm-hmm. To be in those rooms because they, well, you know, that shit sounds good, but that ain't gonna work.
Right. Yeah. It's like she's the one who's talked and explained voter suppression really well because she's like, man, like it's great. Like I know you want people to get out and vote, but sometimes it's not so simple. Sometimes there are people that have their registrations purged and they have no idea. Like there's that multi-layered area of voting is just like the clearest one I can give an example to. Where a lot of people don't realize that. And so having somebody like her on our board of advocates that we can have phone calls with to kind of explain these things, and that's what we can get out to fans. That's what we can talk about on our platforms. That's been really cool. And so we're just going to continue to try to use that. And it obviously helped us in figuring out what supporting Warnock would look like. So, it's been really helpful, and we're just going to continue to have people like that.
You mentioned before that the WNBA and NBA, you know, different situations in terms of where you guys feel you were effective. You're saying that as the WNBA, you felt like you had to, you know, your platform comes from playing. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, how did you feel when the NBA decided to come back? Do you feel like that was the right move for them as well?
Yeah, this was tough too because when we actually had a conversation with all the players that evening. So we had a vigil to honor everything, honor Jacob Blake, Breonna Taylor, everybody. And then we also had a players only meeting. And we, one thing we emphasized was like, we're not the NBA. So obviously it made sense to support what they did, but ultimately their decision moving forward might not be ours. And so there are things that we obviously look to them for, whether it's like certain union matters, stuff like that. And there are other things where they're their own entity. And so in their decision to play or not to play, like it was tough. I mean, I think it would have been tough for us to continue to play if they chose not to play, even if it did make more sense to us.
Right.
But I think ultimately we were kind of at the point where we still would have had to come up with whatever decision we felt was best for us.
Right.
Hey, before we let you go, I mean, and again, our guest is Elizabeth Williams, just a phenomenal human being and a great,
thank you.
A great leader with Atlanta Dream, who actually helped trigger probably maybe one of the most unique protests that I've seen in team sports. I mean, I was trying to go through my Rolodex, even mm-hmm. when Milwaukee plays. When have I seen this before? Have I ever seen this before? And you hate to say, you know, as a journalist, this is the first time, because then you'll get a
right,
No, actually, no. I think we're on safe ground. This is pretty unique.
Yeah.
A, what do your parents feel? You know, how mm-hmm. do your parents feel about this, about you leading this stuff? How have they been supportive? I'm sure they've been supportive at some point, but how do they feel about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they were surprised too. They obviously know my personality. I usually stay out of trouble. I like keep my head down, kind of do my work. But they're surprised, but also happy. I mean, they're proud of me for finding my voice and leading this league. And obviously, like if they see me on CNN or something, they get really excited. Like, oh, like I can't believe this is you. But we're so proud. And ultimately, growing up, I mean, the biggest thing they emphasize is treating people fairly and equally. So that's what I'm going out and supporting and talking about. And so they're proud that I'm continuing to talk about something that's so important and reminding people just be a decent human. And so I think they're really proud about that.
And then last for me, until you come back, you got to come back in part two to this. What's life in the bubble been like for you emotionally? I guess the camaraderie is probably great, but what's life in the bubble been like? In the wobble.
It's been interesting. I was actually just talking to some of my teammates about, obviously we want to go home, but we don't want to go back to like not knowing that people, if they have COVID or not, right? Like we're kind of in this safe space where, like, yes, we're supposed to have our mask on, but like when we're outside, like it feels very comfortable and kind of like normal. So in that sense, like I'm very appreciative of how safe we felt from a COVID standpoint. I mean, playing every other day is tough physically, especially, we're just not used to that. And that's been an adjustment. It is also a little weird seeing every single team in one place all the time. Like, a lot of us have bikes because the campus is really big. So like you're biking and you like wave, see somebody from Seattle, wave, see somebody from Phoenix. Like it's just, it's weird. But I think the league has done a good job in just trying to make us feel as comfortable as possible. Like last night we had like this massive like seafood fest, basically. Like they had music and it was like the Bayou and King Cake and all this stuff. So the league's just try to make it feel as comfortable as possible. But it is a little weird. Like we're all in one place playing basketball. And so we've just tried to take advantage of it.
I mean, but does that make it hard to hate your opponent? What does it do to, let's just talk about competition. Cause you're supposed to have at least some degree of resentment or something to your opponent. But does this make that hard to kind of like hate people?
I don't know, because I mean, Taurasi said it the other game, cause the referees also stay in the hotel. So she was like yelling at them saying like, oh, I'll see you in the lobby later. Like the competition is still there. So once you're on the court, it's different. Yeah. Like I'll see you in the lobby. So no, the competition is, is definitely still there. Once we hit the court, it's different. Like,
she was saying that in jest, wasn't she?
Yeah.
We think so.
Meg, I don't know. With Taurasi, who knows?
Exactly. Yeah, so, but I do think, I mean, even if you watch the games, like, they're so competitive. I mean, once you're between those lines, you could see it with NBA guys, even with no crowd. Like, once you're between those lines, it's different, you know?
Again, I lied. I said this last question. But I'm intrigued by the competition because, you know, most of us, whatever you play, when you start playing sports, there were never crowds. I mean, mm-hmm. most of the stuff you were doing was in practice, try to make the team, mm-hmm. impress the coach, mm-hmm. and the playground. You know, there were never crowds. The crowds almost became part of the show business, and sometimes you change your personality to play to the crowd and that. So I'm just wondering, does this get back to the real almost purity of competition? You know, like, you know, you'd be mm-hmm. in the playground all day. Mm-hmm. You don't mm-hmm. go to one court or the other. It's like the same court, the same stuff. But I'm wondering, mm-hmm. does this get back to kind of the purity of just competition, where it's about the competition?
Yeah, a little bit. It's kind of like a glorified pickup game, you know? I don't want to say there's nobody watching because it's on TV, but there's nobody. Yeah. But there's nobody there, like, you could go and high five or whatever. Like, it's just your team, like, you're riding for your team. Like, that's all you got. So it does make, like, a unique experience from a competition standpoint.
Right. Do you miss the crowds, though?
Yeah, there are definitely moments where I'm like, dang, I wish we had some crowd noise or something to hype us up. Right. But, yeah. Especially when you're down, too, because usually that's when the crowd will pick up and then you kind of get that energy back. It's hard when it's just your bench. It's like, all right, come on. Because you're like, dang, anybody else?
But then you don't have to worry about, we talked to Zach Zarba, the official. And we said, well, you also have to get booed. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, there are no boos. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. And as our guest has been, Elizabeth Williams of the Atlanta Dream, graciously. What does it look like? What are the next, you know, how are you feeling about the competition? Speaking of competition, how are you feeling? About where you are, competition, you know, where you guys are headed?
Yeah, we're in a little rough spot right now. We technically still have a chance at playoffs. We play tonight. We have to win today to get into playoffs because they're a team that's right ahead of us. But I do feel good. I feel like our team is unfortunate because we had so many new players through free agency and trades. And it was unfortunate that we didn't really get a true training camp and a true full season, just because from a chemistry standpoint, this is like the worst type of season to try to find chemistry, because we don't have a lot of practice time either, because, again, we're playing so often. But we're actually slowly starting to find that. And I think that's why I'm excited for tonight's game and the games moving forward, because even though it's a little late, we still technically have a chance, and we've been playing better. So.
Well, best of luck, Elizabeth Williams. Boot the L word out of office.
Right. I'll say it again. You guys are really, showing to be a group of, you know, one of the biggest groups of leaders we have in the country. So if change is made, I think people will look back at the athletes themselves as being the spearhead of it. And then moving on in the future, in terms of if we can move on to a different administration, there's no doubt that the WNBA and NBA would have played a huge role in that. So I think, I don't think we've ever seen athletes take this big of a role in the mm-hmm. political system as they are right now.
Yeah. For sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for everything you're done and about to do. And good luck tonight. And look to having you back on, seriously, because I think there's a lot more to talk about. But thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Great. Elizabeth Williams from the Atlanta Dream. Really great, man. Really outstanding. Welcome back. Rose Pod, Bill Rodino Sports. I just heard from the great Elizabeth Williams of the Atlanta Dream here with Jamal Murphy. Hey, Jamal, let's talk. I guess we cannot have a conversation without mentioning the great John Thompson.
Right.
Who passed away Sunday night. I don't know, man. I'm supposed to be writing something for the undefeated. I mean, I'm going to write something for the undefeated, but it's still a little surreal. Because, you know, Coach Thompson, man, is, you know that, you know, our lives have a beginning, middle, and an end. But still, just some people you think about just larger than life, you think they're never going to die, you know. And for some reason, you know, Coach Thompson is just one of those people. Just such a big presence. What were your thoughts about Thompson? I don't know how much interaction you have with him, but just your thoughts about it. You cover a lot of college hoops. Just your thoughts about Coach Thompson.
Oh, I mean, you know, an absolute giant on the court and off the court. I probably only interacted with him, you know, once or twice, short exchanges, you know, in the time I've covered college basketball. He was always there at the Big East tournament. But I mean, he had an influence on me since I was a little kid. You know, when I first started watching basketball, one of the first games I remember watching was the Villanova Georgetown game when Villanova upset them. And, I was instantly a Georgetown fan, and I'm a Georgetown fan to this day, and they haven't even been good in I don't know how long, you know, and right. I still root for them because of John Thompson. On the court, the ferociousness, defensive intimidation, the unapologetically black. I think he's like the epitome of, you know, himself being unapologetically black, creating a team that was unapologetically black, players. Remember, it was always funny, like, I've heard people say, oh, we used to think Georgetown was a HBCU.
Right.
And while I never thought that, but it was crazy. Like, they never had any white players on the team. I mean, all teams had at least like one or two white guys on the team. Georgetown had like no white guys. Right. And then when they did have a white guy, it was like the weirdest thing ever to see a white guy, in a Georgetown uniform.
Who's this guy? Yeah.
You know, so I mean, he spoke out on all these issues that are going on now. John Thompson was fighting for 40 years ago, you know, for the rest, you know, throughout his entire life. So he really epitomizes what's going on right now. For you, what was it like covering him? Because, you know, I was looking at him on television for the most part as a fan, but what was it like covering
him? Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, some of it was a little intimidating in a way. One of my best friends, Reggie Ballard, his father was Reggie's from D.C. Mm-hmm. And his dad was a real big figure, Kaya. His dad was a real big figure in the D.C. recreation thing. So Coach Thompson knew Kaya. He knew Reggie's dad. And so when I told you, me and Reggie are great friends, he said, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, well, Kaya. I remember saying, hey, Kaya, you know. So I kind of like, you know, he had to swore it. And he said, okay, wait a minute, let me put it down. You know, I won't behead you. But he was a great mentor in terms of just being a black head coach, really high profile, but who would, I learned a lot just about, we could be black men and talk about these issues, but I'm still a coach. You're a journalist. You know, never, you know, don't you ever forget it, because I ain't forgetting it. There's always that line there, but we'd be on conference calls. John Chaney, George Ravel, Nolan Richardson, John, we'd be on these conference calls talking about how are we going to get more black head coaches? How are we going to get more black writers, editors, you know? Right. So at one level, and then we started this tradition, me, Wilbon, Mike Wilbon, the late Brian Burwell. We'd meet the coffee shop at the Final Four. And we talked to like 3 or 4 in the morning about stuff, you know. And then we started every Final Four, we'd add more writers, more coaches, till at the peak of it, we may have a big room, man. It'd be like 30, 40 writers and young coaches in it. You know, and it became something that everybody looked forward to. And then, but you know, John and I, you know, one or two disagreements right. about stuff. And, you know, I always say another thing, we shared the same birthday. Our birthdays were September 2nd.
Wow.
And so every September 2nd, I would try to somehow send him a note or whatever. And then once I was trying to get in touch with Michael Graham.
Right.
You know, Michael Graham, freshman, and he was somehow, he was like staying on campus, on the Georgetown campus. So, of course, being a journalist, I found out where he was, and I slid a note under his door. And so when I called John to say, hey, happy birthday, yeah, but, you know, I expect more out of you to try to get in touch with Michael Graham, you know.
And, right.
And, but again, it was like, hey, John, you know, yeah, but I'm still a journalist.
Right.
And he said, yeah, and I'm still a coach. This is my program. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm a journalist. And, you know, it kind of was like, always reminded, yeah, well, this is my program. This is my thing. I said, well, I'm a journalist. He said, yeah, right. Okay. So you go to church, you go to your church, I go to mine. But I think there was always a mutual respect that at the bottom line, we had blackness. We were black men. He was an older, you know, he was an elder who I respected. And I'm a journalist, but I'm black first. I'm right. A black man first, not a journalist first. I'm a black man, but at the same time, I got a job to do, you know, and you got a thing to protect. So there was always that. And I think that, and I think maybe young journalists have to know, there's always a line there. We could work together, we could respect each other, but there's always kind of like a line there. But I think the override thing was, we are black people, and we're working to move black people forward, move the ball forward. So, yeah, that's sort of my recollection. But just want to, you know, reach out to any of his, you know, family may be listening, or
right. Those
people admired him that I admired him too, and I loved him. You know, as somebody who really had a great impact on my professional life. Just, there are a lot of stories, but one is we're in New Orleans getting ready. We had this meeting, you know, at the Final Four. We always had our meetings. And so we're trying to be at one restaurant, but we just had too many people. So we had to improvise and move to another place. And they were going to let us in, but there were still chairs set up and tables. And we had to move the table. So everybody was just sitting looking at it. So I remember I just stepped forward. I started moving the tables, you know, and everybody followed. I remember Thompson said something like, "That boy has leadership skills." Right. And he said it like that, but, you hear that and you say, yeah, I guess I do have leadership skills, you know?
Right.
And I'm like in my 30s, you know?
Right.
But every time I think back on that, I think back on, that's kind of what a coach does, you know, that, or that's what an adult in a position of authority does. When you recognize somebody having certain types of skills, you let them know, no matter how you let them know. You know, it's like kind of like, yeah, that boy has leadership.
right. And motivational skills.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, man, he will be, he made an impact. And as you always say, I don't expect everybody I coach to be loving me, but I just hope to have an impact on people. So,
right.
Yeah, man. Glad I got to know him. Glad I was in his orbit, his universe. And the lesson for all of us is, will we have that kind of impact on younger people? You know, it's kind of the name of the game. So what else you got, man? I guess whatever else you got, we can save it.
Yeah, we can save it. We can end it there, you know, with the great coach John Thompson. You know, he has his, you know, probably his most famous players is actually, you know, still coaching Georgetown, Patrick Ewing, yeah. Just, you know, that shows you,
yeah,
you know, part of his legacy. And let me just ask you that. I mean, because his whole career was about, you know, improving the lives of black people. And particularly in his profession, and we still have problems there. And I'm sure he would have been the first to tell you that. What is in that part of it? We didn't really make. I'm sure we didn't make the progress to this point that he would have liked in his profession. You know.
Well, he was part of the Black Coach Association, part of the founding of it. And again, as we were talking with Elizabeth Williams, this is all part of the eternal relay that is never over. You do as much as you can do, and then you hand it off, and you hope that the young coaches are, you know, whatever white folks you coach, although he didn't coach men, but you know, white, but you know, the white people who you make contact with, who are going to be in positions of power and control, do the right thing,
right?
And that they hire black folks, they hire black men and women, you know, that they try to diversify us as much as you can do,
right?
You know,
so. And anybody who has become a coach, you know, who is a coach now, you know, was inspired in some way by John Thompson. I remember talking, you know, I did a piece for The Undefeated on the Big East coaches, you know, 50% of the Big East coaches being African-American. And when you talk to those coaches, they all were quick to bring up John Thompson, even guys who you think might have been too young to really remember, but they all bring up John Thompson. Stu Jackson, who works for the Big East, you know, constantly brought up John Thompson as you know, someone they look at in terms of, you know, creating diversity and how important it is and being able to speak their minds. There's no question he had a huge impact. We just, you know, like you said, it's a relay race and we got some more laps to run.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, man, it's been a great show. Thanks again to Elizabeth Williams of the Atlanta Dream. Great human being, great interview.
Yes. Before we sign off, of course, subscribe to the program, to the podcast, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts, on Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, etc. Leave any message you want. We'll talk about it on air. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BrosPod and on Facebook at Bill Roden on Sports.
All right. See everybody next week. God bless. Stay safe.